Welcome back, everybody, to our show, The Three Tribesmen. And today, still here with my same guys, Brad Ike, Onye, and your favorite guy, Timmy Tayo here. Today's a little different, man. We got our very first guest on this podcast, the first time we ever had a guest. And this person is someone who's very dear to me, my friend, an old roommate of mine, super, super talented guy, fashion designer, model, actor. I don't want to say, are you a musician too? I don't know. I never seen you sing or anything.
I can dabble.
I know you've been rapping sometimes. You're a little freestyler.
Might find out.
And this is my guy. Hey, he needs no more introduction. Obi Wanko, thank you for joining our podcast today, brother.
Of course.
Yes, sir.
Man, it's good to see you, man.
Good to see you.
The flyest one on here. You can already tell just off looking at us, like he's a fashion designer. I mean, I don't even know where to start from. Like, where do we start?
Because basically, tell us about yourself. Like, you are Nigerian.
Yeah.
Sweet. Igbo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. There you go. Igbo Kwenu. All right. got to. Yeah, tell us. Let's start from the beginning. Let's start with growing up. Yeah. How was it being Nigerian and being, I'm going to take it that you lived in Boston?
Yeah.
How was that growing up?
Yeah, so growing up in Boston, it was...
Were you born in Boston?
Yeah, I was born in Boston. Okay. And then my little sister was born in Nigeria. So I actually went back to Nigeria for like 2 years as a kid and then came back to the States.
Gotcha.
But I don't really have any remembrance of any of that really happening. So most of like my time was spent in Boston, and I grew up in the inner city, High Park, Jamaica Plain, and then my parents started doing better, and we ended up moving to the suburbs. So got really two experiences where, quite frankly, my growing up experience, I was around a lot of Nigerians, like the Nigerian Catholic community, going to church Monday, Wednesday, Friday night vigil.
Like, we all know about
night
that.
Vigil, like, shoot, you know, mom would even ask if we want to go to the Saturday. And then we're like, damn, Sunday's church. Like, so, you know, that was really growing up. And then when we moved into the suburbs, I felt like the Nigerian community wasn't as strong over there. So, you know, I went to church every Sunday. But I think the cool thing about growing up in the inner city and in a Nigerian community was you're able to just get automatic friends, you know, especially people who are like-minded like you. So as you're trying to understand the culture and, you know, what you're really going through, you at least have some people that can connect and give you some advice. Sure. Versus when I was growing up in the suburbs, didn't really have any Nigerian people around me. So, you know, at that time, you kind of have to cope and understand things a little bit differently.
Right. I can definitely relate to the suburb life, man. It's like I kind of mentioned on previous episodes, you know, living in the suburbs, you're probably going to be like the only African family in the whole entire city.
Facts.
So I didn't grow up in the city. You know, in L.A., that's where all the Nigerians were and stuff like that. When I got out to the suburbs all by myself. So tell me, when you did move out there and you're by yourself, how did you kind of stay connected to your culture, right? I know you said you're going to church every Sunday. But were there still some things that you, like, was it hard to kind of adjust you going to school and, you know, was there any kind of bullying and stuff like that? Was it different? Like, what were you around? Were you around, you know, white people, Hispanics? Like, what was out there in the suburbs?
Yeah, so in the suburbs, definitely more white people and, like, more African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So just people who weren't from Nigeria, which was more of a shock to me because, you know, I just thought I'm like, oh, shoot, everyone, if you're black, you're Nigerian or something. Like, I don't know. Like, until you grow up, you know what you know. Yeah. So definitely grew up around, you know, a lot of white people, a lot of Spanish people. But I feel like my school, I had Indian people around me. I had Asian people. Like, so I got a wide mix, but I would say for the most part, I would say like 70% was like fixed white. And just with how my parents wanted me to grow up, I was very into sports. Mm. I was very into school. School was big. My mom went to Harvard University.
Nice.
And, like, my dad went to Northeastern. So, like, they were very adamant about us doing well.
Repeat that again. Your mom went to where?
My mom went to Harvard.
Harvard. Okay. Respect.
Yeah. So she wasn't playing about school. But I think more so for me, I didn't really want to play about school either.
Right,
so
right.
It was kind of like a mutual thing. And I think the one thing that they didn't really care about, but I cared about, was sports. I was like, I want to be a student and an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I was probably one of the first people out of my family to really ever take sports seriously, mm-hmm. just as seriously as school at that time. Right. So, yeah, that sports gave me, honestly, it just opened up the world, honestly, for me, if I had to be honest and mm-hmm. looking back at it now, just because it allowed me to travel, get out of my comfort zone, get introduced to people that I normally wouldn't be introduced to, and then also provide like a streamlined way for me to just stay on check.
So, hold on, not even to cut you off, Brad, but just to get into that, so, because I believe we had a conversation mm-hmm. previous episode where we were talking about not being supported by our, you know, our African side of the family when it came to, like, sports and everything. Mm-hmm. Now, on your side, how did that dynamics work? Because your parents were heavy into mm-hmm. education and everything, and, you know, Nigerians, they don't play with education. Yeah. And they kind of see sports as something that's a gimmick almost
yeah.
until someone actually makes it inside
of a real thing.
Right. It's yeah. not a real thing. So how did your parents embrace that?
Yeah, it was more so actually my parents embraced, my dad like embraced sports pretty big, where I was really focused on sports like baseball, football, soccer growing up. Like I played all those. And then my parents got divorced and then it was mostly like my mom in the house. And honestly, I took a break from sports for a little bit just because I didn't really think I could go anywhere with at that time until honestly, sorry, people around me started bringing that sport energy back to me. They're like, bro, you should really take this seriously. Like, I think you could do something. And so I started getting back into sports, like, you know, when I was 13, 14 going into high school. And then I think at that time I had to like tap into like my faith more. Mm. And, you know, I think being Nigerian and just being around just a very like holy community, maybe they believed everyone's going to be doctors and lawyers and right. things of that nature. But I used that faith to believe I could do something in sports, and I didn't really know what it was, but I knew I could at least do something.
So first of all, nice to meet you. I'm one of the other
yes.
other Africans that had divorced parents. There's not mm-hmm. a lot of us out there, so facts. I can relate on that level as well too. So what did sports, what was it able to provide? I know you mm-hmm. said you ran track in college.
Yeah.
Did you get a track scholarship or did you get an academic scholarship, or was yeah. it kind of a combination of both?
I actually got a academic scholarship okay. From Boston College. So the school actually didn't have any track and field yeah. scholarships. Because it's so Title IX was a thing where mm. basically the same amount of female scholarships has to be the same amount of male right. scholarships. Yeah. So the female track team had scholarships, but mm. the males didn't because we had sports like football. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, basically football. like, yeah. That like, you know, just kind of over tipped yeah. the balance yeah. where, yeah, so I ended up getting, you know, like, academic scholarship to go there where they covered like maybe like 75% to 80% of it, and that was good enough for me to want to go to that school, even though I had full offers from like UMass Amherst, UConn, talk like offers from Michigan, Stanford, UVA, like, but I was just so locked in on like going to Boston College. Mm-hmm. And it was really because I was Boston homegrown
right.
and I just felt like the first time I visited there, they just embraced me differently, mm-hmm. even though it felt like where I was growing up more in the suburbs. But I think it was the one thing that I never felt in Boston that probably a lot of people did. They're like, isn't Boston such a racist city? I'm like, right. I never had
that's,
no one.
That's what I would have thought.
Like, I never really
felt that.
I mean, yeah, you have people dropping the N-word when, you know, yeah. with songs and stuff, but I never really had it be so overt. Right. And I think it was just the energy I carried. Like,
right.
it wasn't coming to me, so.
It actually takes me back, because a lot of Nigerians come from Nigeria and move to Texas,
mm-hmm.
Chicago,
Maryland,
D.C., Maryland, some Virginia. Like, take us back to, like, your parents. I don't know if you have ever had this conversation with mm-hmm. them, but how does a Nigerian
want to end up
in a cold place? Like,
yeah,
I mean, there's some places in Nigeria end up like New York where it's cold also, but like
mm-hmm.
I don't really have many friends that really are from Boston,
mm-hmm.
so I'm not sure what the population is like even yeah. of Nigerians or Africans in general
right.
in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
You were gonna say, honestly, I didn't even know there was Nigerians. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So I'm very curious to know, like, how did they end up in Boston? And they're still in Boston. I mean, your mom is still in Boston, right?
Yeah.
yeah. So walk us through that part. Have you ever had that yeah. conversation with them? How did they end up in there?
So, yeah, I think a lot of Nigerians end up in Boston because the schooling system is really good.
Okay. Now,
Boston houses, if you think of like some of the best. There's MIT, there's Harvard, there's Boston College, there's BU, there's Bowdoin, there's Brandeis, there's Bates. These are schools that a lot of people don't know, but they're smaller NESCAC schools that really hold crazy academic standards. Right. You know, I think Bentley's there, one of the biggest. Berkeley's extension school, like Berkeley school, I think in California,
they
have an extension school in Boston where some of the best talented musicians go there to teach. So I think, Boston, I think that's why a lot of, Africans.
So your mom just ended up going there and met your dad there, or it was like a partnership then moved to Boston for school?
Yeah, so she met my dad in Boston because she was studying at Harvard, and then she was getting her master's in biology and chemistry and statistics.
Wow.
So
how did she get to Harvard from Nigeria?
She graduated top of her class in whatever secondary third, she was always just top of her class. So I think, let's say, one or two people get the opportunity to go.
That's amazing.
So she was one of those people. Visa. Yeah.
So that's unique. You said that they met in America. Like, I don't know. I don't know, but I can't speak for everybody here, but like, all my friends' parents always met back home.
Yeah.
So that, like, you're one of the first person I ever heard say that. And I know this generation is going to be different, like the new generation moving forward, because a lot of Nigerians are out here and they're going to meet here. But like, most people that I know around my age, their parents met back home. I mean, met back in Nigeria, and they came out here together.
Mm-hmm, right.
So that's unique to me. That's crazy. How did that? I mean, what was your dad? Was your dad at Boston College, or what was he doing?
So he was at Northeastern, and he was studying business.
Okay.
And then I still don't even really know exactly like how they like the exact story of how they met.
Never want to tell you how they met. It's like a taboo conversation.
Yeah. So. Okay. But they met, and then my mom at that time was she like was working at like one of these like fast food restaurants. I can't do you remember those restaurants? They'll serve like chicken, gravy, corn on the so she was working at one of those places, and then just grinding with us, and then had kids, and then that's kind of how it all started.
So a question I have. So do you speak the language?
No, small now.
Small. Okay, understand. So, how was that growing up? Did you feel left out, or did you feel included? Like, because for myself, I'm not sure. Everybody's different. Tim actually knows the language. He knows the Yoruba language. I can understand Igbo language. Speaking it is a problem. Is an issue for me. Mm-hmm. Like for yourself, was that an issue for you?
Yeah, it was. Like at first, I felt like it was an issue. But it honestly motivated me to want to understand better, because then you have your parents call you Indiocha, like, this boy needs to learn now. So I was like, just off of like wanting to be better for myself, I gained a better understanding. And I think people around me, I think that was probably one of the first times where I think everyone around me started to actually see like my intelligence in a different way, because like, wow, he actually just woke. One day he didn't really know any Igbo, but yet now he's regurgitating all of our conversations. Mm-hmm. So I think it was just, it motivated me to actually want to learn about the culture. And then as I actually got older, I actually wanted to understand my roots, where I came from, wanted to go back more often, and then, eventually, give back in a different way, through, my brand and, other things I'm doing.
They ever speak to you in the language?
Yeah. So, all the time, yeah.
Like most African parents,
you have to respond.
They didn't ever change accent. It's just the same. The way they just speak the way they want to speak. And as a kid, even if you don't speak back the same language, you still understand what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. It used to be like that, though. It used to be like that for me. Yeah, like it used to be like. I remember, like, I can visually remember, like, my parents being like, "Oh, Paulo, go to the Paulo." And I used to say that at school, not knowing that I was speaking a completely different language. I know Paulo as the living room. You understand? Yeah. Like, that's what I knew. So, but I was going out in public. I was just like, "Yeah, we're about to go to the Paulo." They were just like, "Bro, what are you talking about?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm like, oh crap, I'm not noticing that I'm clearly speaking a different language to them." But with time, it kind of like faded away. The more you try to like get into society, and you know, society molds you once you become of age. You know, your parents sets the foundation, but mm-hmm. society kind of really kind of molds who you're gonna be. And I just, dude, I just little by little just start forgetting the language, bro. Like,
they ever speak mm-hmm. to you in the language?
Absolutely, all the time. And I, okay. like, I see a ghost. Like, you know, you know, there's certain words you pick up, especially like the very basic words you kind of pick up. But yeah, they speak to us all the time. Like, my aunt still does it all the time. And then she'll like start talking in English and stuff like that. But like, there's certain things you kind of like, okay, I kind of understand what she's saying because I heard this before.
Yeah.
But you know,
I mean, I grew up in Nigeria, so for me, it's even deeper than that. It's one thing to know Yoruba, right? Yoruba itself, but then to actually know, like, my mom's from Ondo State, so they have a different type of language in Ondo State than Yoruba, and it's all Yoruba, but it's like a different
centralized
dialect.
And then there's a different,
you know, My mom would say to her siblings and her mother, my grandma and all that, but I can't speak it back to her in that same dialect. I have to speak it back to her in Yoruba. That's, you know, it's like you can be from Igbo and speak the Igbo language, but within that Igbo culture, there's a different, like, dialect. You know what I mean? Sure. Dialects. Yeah. And that's what I probably struggle with. But yeah, absolutely. I grew up there, so I already knew how to speak it, you know. Yeah. Now, when I speak to people, they might say, you're not proper, or you're not speaking the right way. Yeah. At least I understand it. You you got to speak it back to you perfectly, but at least I understand it. So let's start a fast track a bit. Mm-hmm. These two guys, Cali guys, mm-hmm. I'm someone who went to school in Texas, and then my journey to Los Angeles, California is a lot different. Mine was because my job actually brought me to LA. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a dream or anything.
Yeah.
For you, it's like you, and I know you, you know. Yeah. I know you came out here for a job, but you didn't just come out here for a job. You actually wanted to be a part. You wanted to come to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So what made you want to come to LA? Mm-hmm. And it's crazy to see this trajectory, because everything you envisioned is like now becoming a real thing. Like you've accomplished so much things. I was, even before the show podcast started, I was just talking about some of your accomplishment and being on the Grammy stage, like all these sort of things. Like, what made you want to come to LA? Mm-hmm. First question. And what made you want to get into that entertainment art world? Like, let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah. So I wanted to come to LA. At that time, I was, let's fast forward to actually probably when these thoughts started downloading in my head. Like, so like my junior year, if you had asked me, I'm like, I'm staying in Boston. Like, so at that time I was doing really well at Boston College. I was able to like set school records. Like, I was doing well academically. I was doing well professionally, like at that time, for what people saw as well professionally. Like, I had an internship at Ernst & Young. And then I also was starting my own entrepreneurial efforts that were doing well. So, you know, it was actually probably the first time, I was probably one of the first like original brand ambassadors, like before social media was a thing. So like, I was working with companies like Coca-Cola, Red Bull, Yik Yak, and I was doing community activations, and that's without social media. I wasn't using Instagram, nothing that's like organic guerrilla marketing. Wow. And so everything was going really well. And I think my senior year, I had a really fun summer, but the job and everything I was doing didn't make sense. Like, I was like, I feel like I'm just way more talented than this. And I would tell people about it, and then they would start calling me like arrogant and things of that nature. Like, oh, you think you're too, I'm like, no, I actually do.
You just
like,
feel it.
Yeah, just like, you know, how am I able to do all these things and still feel like I can do way more? Like, I should feel maxed out. I'm like, this ain't nothing. So I wanted, my senior year, I had a job offer from a big consulting company. And I honestly was like, I don't want to stay in Boston, you know, almost to the point where if they weren't going to relocate me, shoot, I was going to maybe stay for 6 or 12 months or not even go and just try to actually get a job in LA. So I got them to relocate me straight to California. Nice. And so my senior year, I was like, I'm going to really go into the entertainment industry. And I just started, I wasn't able to actually pursue anything until after I graduated college, which was a little bit of a bummer, just because of, at that time, NIL wasn't a thing. So athletes couldn't make money off their likeness. Mm-hmm. And so the second I graduated, I started taking photos, videos, and applying to castings, ended up booking one commercial in Boston with this company called Core Power. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it was a football commercial and it aired on ESPN. Took that, all the pictures I had, and I moved to LA and just started trying to figure out the industry. And I just thought that I could just end up, let me rewind. One of the forefronting thoughts as a kid was watching people on TV or watching people I admire. Yeah. And honestly, not knowing how they got there. Like, mm-hmm. you know, your parents teach you, oh, if you do this, you can become a, like, but how do you get from there to there? Like, but no one had that blueprint. Mm-hmm. And so I was always intrigued by that blueprint.
Well, I think that's why a lot of our parents are so stuck on like being a lawyer, doctor, and all that, because mm-hmm. they know it's a streamlined process.
Yeah.
You go to school, you go to graduate school, you go to, you know, medical school, you become a doctor.
Mm-hmm. Much about art.
Right. Yeah. So with what you're doing, it's not like that. Like, it's no, like, you go to acting school, you automatically become an actor. Like, no, there's a lot of different things that come into play, right? Whether it's mm-hmm. networking and auditions and stuff like that. So I think that's probably why. But let me, before we kind of dive in deeper into that, mm-hmm. how did your parents feel about you moving away? I mean, you mm-hmm. were at Boston College, they're Harvard and Northeastern grads. How do your parents feel about you moving into something completely different than mm-hmm. probably what they, I mean, right. being African, than what they envisioned?
Yeah.
Did they accept it? Were they supportive? Mm-hmm. You know, were they angry? You know, were they happy? What did they do?
Yeah, it was, I would say, I'll probably talk about it from like a family perspective and then like my mom's perspectives, because it was all completely different.
Right.
You know, I just say this transparently because anyone can believe what they thought or said. But, you know, I know what was I was hearing 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And my family was confused. Mm-hmm. Like,
no, you worked hard as hell.
Yeah.
You see what we're doing. You worked hard as hell. Mm-hmm. And then you're literally going off. In their eyes, you're diverting, going off track now.
Right. Yeah.
Now it's almost like, what are you doing with your life?
Right. Like for real. You understand?
Like, embarrass me.
Like, I remember just like my uncle's like, you just got a degree from one of the best schools.
Yeah.
You did business. The top 5 business school.
So you can Mickey Mouse. So you can, like, Mickey Mouse around.
What is, you need prayer. You need fire. You need
like, you work so hard. We understand. Like, we understand you don't want to be an athlete anymore. You did well, but we didn't even you supported it, but they didn't really they weren't banking on me becoming a professional athlete.
Right.
And so I think they were just concerned. They didn't want me to go in the wrong direction with everything that I had built. But my mom was like really like the pillar in all that, in the sense where she was like, I believe you can do it.
That's dope.
She was like, you haven't showed me anything over the course of being able to be your mom over these years. You haven't showed me any reason why you would fail.
That's dope.
Shout out to mom.
No, for real. Like, and that was the confidence. That's all I really needed. Right. You really just need one person to use.
No, your mom. Yeah. That takes care of everything else. Yeah. She's okay. I'm okay.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Yeah. So like, even like when my uncles or aunts or family friends were saying X, Y, and Z, it didn't really matter because I already got the cosign that I needed.
Right.
So, and then my mom, like, supporting me, like so, like, when I first graduated college, I had no money. I'd spent all my interned for 2 summers at Ernst & Young. I was making more than people's parents make as an intern, and so I was just stupid at that. At that time, I was buying clothes, going out to the clubs, like, oh, table shoot, bro. I just got paid, like, and then you're
not paying rent,
so it's like you actually making, you stacking, like, so it was, and then I also had businesses, the brand ambassador stuff, and then I had my own company. So I had 3 streams of income as a college student with no rent, no car, no nothing. So it was, but you know, now when I reflect on that, I'm like, oh, I was just spending money on stupid stuff. Like, but you need to get all that stuff out of you.
Facts.
So like, you need to, like, I'm like, wait, just seeing your money just go away for a whole summer and like during the school year. But, so yeah, it was my mom was definitely the big support system. And, you know, when I first needed to move to California, had no bread, she was like, all right, I'll pay your down payment for your apartment, first month's rent, and you just pay me back whenever you get it. I'm like, cool.
That payback, though, it's just, you're not, she knows she's not getting it back. She's just going to say it. She's my mom gave me a loan for my first car. I don't think I've ever given her that money back. Support, though. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
yeah.
So you moved out to Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and we met pretty much as soon as you moved to Los
Angeles. Basically the first 2 or 3 weeks, yeah.
Should we even talk about how we met?
I mean, it's pretty funny how we met.
Oh,
I mean,
man,
shout out to Berko for, you know,
funny. We were at a...
Nightingale.
Was we were at a club, right?
No, it was Nightingale.
My boy was in town, so we had a table, chilling on the table. And then, you know, clubs, they were like all these promoters they bring like the girls to their table and everything. Mm-hmm. So my guy was the one who really got the table. I was there to support my boys in town, Dallas, Texas. And then the girl he was trying to talk to, the main girl he was trying to talk to, was just there. You know, not like she was interested or anything. She was just on the table with us, but he was interested in talking to her. Next thing you know, the bottles, everything coming. Where's the girl at? She's talking to somebody on the other table, next to our table. Oh, wow. Who's the person? This guy. So my boy, daughter, shout out to Marco. So my boy was like, what the heck? Like, this is our table, and this guy, you know how it is, where this is your table, and somebody's over here, like,
right.
talking to somebody else on that table, and I think he got, like, the scared to, like, get kicked out of the section. So this girl did some gangster stuff. She didn't walk out. She just leaped over. She just leaped over to his table. And then at that point, I would be crying, laughing like, yo, my boy.
And he had a sister too. And her sister came.
And they all walked out. Like, I'm like, yo, this guy is, I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
You know, like, damn, bro, like, this girl's.
I ain't gonna lie, that's some fly stuff right
there. Like, you know, this is my boy.
Yeah.
But this cat was like, you know, it was just funny to me. And then he seemed cool, you know. I don't remember how we started talking, but I know I was like, just talking to him, and just from the conversation, because I thought it was funny. I was like, you know, like, you know. And then when we started chatting, he's like, yeah, I just moved from Boston, blah, blah. I was like, oh, cool. I just moved from Texas. I had just moved from Texas, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is when we became cool. He's like, I don't know how we ended up talking about it. He's like, I'm Nigerian. And I was like, you know how it is when somebody, like, it's like being a frat and knowing you see another guy who's in the same frat. It was like an instant bond. Like, you just moved out here, too? Oh, yeah. Let me get your number.
Mm-hmm.
And we got each other's numbers. Months later or so, from there, boys became roommates, lived together in LA. Like we've been friends for those 7 years.
Facts.
He's seen my trajectory. I've seen his trajectory. If anyone can speak on it, I can probably speak a lot on it.
Facts.
And what I've seen in those years that you've been in Los Angeles has been nothing short of amazing. I think first you did something which a lot of people are nervous to do, is take a risk. Like, you quit that job. And I was like, this guy must be, like, it was a good paying job, you know, and
six figures.
He was like, I'm really looking into this modeling and acting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, this guy, you must be crazy. Like, you could still do your job and act.
Yeah.
But he believed in something. Like, he said when he was leaving Boston, like, he just had this feeling like, I can do better. Like, some people are so scared to leave their jobs that it's like, they feel like that's the end all be all. Like, it's like this, like, I don't want to, nah, but you didn't even have anything lined up.
Mm-hmm.
You just said, I'm quitting this job and I'm going to focus on my goal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you've even looked back to another corporate job since then.
No.
Because at least you were thinking, like, maybe I'll go back to it. You haven't looked back.
Yeah.
So can you talk about what you're currently doing now? Like, what are, I know you're in the entertainment business. Can we dive deeper into that? What parts of the business are you in? Mm-hmm. Are you behind the scenes, in front of the cameras? Like,
he can give you a timeline of how it started. So let's start off with that. Like, you quit your job. And you jumped into acting?
Yeah, so I quit the job, got into LA 2017. I quit the job 2018, basically 366 days right after. So I made sure I worked for a year. That was a promise I had for my mom and my family, just in general. I was like, you know, I'll stay at this job for a year, but I'm doing what I want to do after that year's up. Because it's a little guilt trip. I did get a degree. I did study finance and accounting,
it
was hard. Like, so I was like, you know what, let me at least see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew from day one it wasn't for me. But I knew I had to, God had called me into being at that job for some reason. And I think the biggest thing that I learned was doing what I didn't want to do for a full year, knowing what I could do, mm-hmm. was like the biggest motivation to like keep me going forever. And so right when I quit, I went full-fledged into modeling, acting, and social media. I was posting like just really everything, like showing like my just like my day-to-day. I was showing my day-to-day more and more at that time. And modeling started doing well. I still remember the thing that really changed everything was like 2018. I didn't book anything for like over 100 straight days. Like I went to like over 100 auditions during the summer one time and I didn't book nothing. Mm. So like I'm walking out that summer like, bro, I might have to go back to that job. And this is just me keeping it a buck, like, yeah. because I saved up and I'm working little jobs here and there, but rent. And I also made an aggressive purchase. I bought a BMW 6 Series the second I quit my job. So like my mom, so even that made my family think I was even more crazy. Like,
and people don't realize, like they think you move to LA, you've made it. Mm-hmm. That's a big
far from, yeah, from
like,
yeah.
They think you've made it, and now mm-hmm. you're buying a Beamer. It's like, oh, you really made it. You book a commercial, I was like, oh, now you really made it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what people always think, but no, keep going. No.
And so I bought the BMW primarily because one, I wanted to challenge myself. I knew if I stepped in that car every single day, I'm gonna feel fear. I'm gonna be nervous, and
yeah.
That is what I needed to wake up every single day. That's what I needed to, you know, before every audition or before anything that I was going to, I had to feel nervous. Like, bro, you know, you got to really put your full energy into this because this car ain't paying for itself and neither is the rent. And you ain't getting them checks every 2 weeks like you used to. So, you know, at that end of the summer, I remember just really contemplating. I was like, you know what, screw it. I'm going to go to Miami, have some fun. And I remember right before I was about to go to Miami, I get a call from my agent. She's like, oh, you have an audition with Nike. I was like, oh, I'm about to go to Miami. She's like, she got to go to the audition. Like, and I was like, screw it. At that time, I didn't really have the money to be changing flights and doing all that. Right. And I was like, like, you know, I didn't have the bread to just, I booked the ticket. It's that ticket, you know. And I remember I changed the flight and I went into the Nike audition. They ended up liking me and called me back the same day.
Damn.
So I had to change the flight again. And then didn't hear back from them. I'm in Miami and my agent's like, you booked Nike. And I was like, oh, shoot. It was cool at first, but then some things happened actually leading into the job. So I'll kind of explain it just so you guys kind of understand like the big difference. Let's say you get booked as a principal, you're like the main person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Nike SAG commercial. SAG means residuals, things of that nature. Yep. So they booked me as the main person. Some in between of me being in Miami and let's say a week before the shoot date, they took me from the main person who's like, Obi can be featured, or it's basically background. I'm a glorified background,
but I'm in a Nike commercial.
Right.
And I remember being just so distraught and like, just like my energy just being killed. And my agent, and this is still why I'm with my agent today. Like, she's like my second mother, just because she gave me that same belief like my mother did, like in a different field. She was like, you just need to walk in there and show them why you were number one in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it really hit me. I was like, I'm still getting paid. Let me just go in. And I went into that Nike commercial just honestly thinking I was the best. And the second they put the clothes on me and they put me behind the people that they booked me in front of, I still remember the guy looking, he's like, nah, this don't look right. And they bumped me up.
Nice.
So if to know the bump, so let's say I'm getting paid $1,000 to be in the background for the day. Now I'm eligible for residuals and automatic like 10, 20, 30K. And I end up getting used in the whole entire commercial as the main principal because it looked awkward when you're putting someone shorter or less athletic. And I'm coming off me being an athlete. Yeah, so right. like I'm a real athlete.
Right.
So it's like, you know, and then even performance wise, like I can really perform. Yep. Like I don't take light takes. Like that's the one thing.
Organic.
Yeah. So I'm locked in. I treat going to set like, bro, we training for ACCs, bro. Like, you know, I'm trying to kill them. Right. Like, so I end up booking it, and bro, that job paid me like over 50 racks and changed the course. I moved to New York the following year, got a model in New York and really jumpstart my career. Came back from New York, did the Grammys, and then the pandemic hit. And I was from that Nike job, I went on a booking spree. Like, I don't think I've ever not worked on a monthly basis since 2018 or 2019.
Talk about some of the brands that you've worked for.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been able to work for Under Armour, Puma, McDonald's, freaking Bose, Theragun, like Gucci, Louis, like honestly, like
you got to also flex a little bit. Who's also posted
LeBron,
you? LeBron has posted you.
LeBron James has posted me on his page. Nice. Like I've done billboards all throughout LA. Like I was the first model LeBron ever put on a billboard for his company Uninterrupted. Mm. He put me on in 2022, 2023. Nice. The reason why I think I feel very satisfied with my modern career, where I was able to make a transition, every goal that I set for it, I accomplished. Like I wanted to work with people who I respected. And so I got to work with people like Tyler, ASAP, Dapper Dan, Justin Timberlake, and just be around some like crazy energy rooms, Logan Paul, but I didn't really care about it. But it was just cool to like work with them so early on, Logan and Jake. Both of them had booked me. And so I got all the experiences. Let's say I had a list of every company I wanted to work for. I'm looking at the list. I'm like, bro, Fortune 100. I've worked for almost any company in the Fortune 100.
Nice.
And so then the pandemic hit. And I was like, all right. It was kind of like that standstill moment.
Before you get into that transition, because I would say this. If you ever become roommates, and this is before we first moved out here, mm-hmm. with someone who's trying to be an actor.
Mm-hmm. Actually hit, though.
Man, that's not even what I was trying to say. It sucks getting that knock on your door at 5 a.m. Can you please record this audition for me? I'm like, this guy always like mess, like, hey, man, I'm going to film an audition. Can you keep it quiet? Can you? Mm-hmm. Like, bro. Like, living with, like,
real shit.
But every time I'm trying to knock, like, I've seen it because it's like, I'll be doing the camera. He's like, can you stay in front of it so I can see what angle I want to get? I took an acting class because of him. He was like, you should just take it. I was like, let me see. Maybe I'll be an actor too. It's not for me. But I still took the acting school, was going to class with him, studied it, and I actually understood how much work goes into like memorizing and scripts, being on time, being a professional, understanding the cast members, the crews, like the transcripts, studying up before, like you'd be driving trying to hurry up and try to know your scripts, audition lines, the wait, the production time. I knew a lot just from being your roommate. Mm-hmm. I knew it wasn't for me, but just seeing you be so dedicated at it, I mean, that's a testament to you yourself, because you were always like, you were so determined. Like, you got to give yourself props. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just talent. You were determined to be great.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic happened, and I remember we were sitting there because we were trying to figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. Like, we were doing like stocks, Robin Hood, trying to figure that out. That's all we were doing. Wake up at 5 a.m. California time, trying to figure out what's the play, what's the day, what's the day trading.
Yep.
So we got on Dogecoin.
Dogecoin. And then I remember walking in one day, and I was just always constantly see him watch YouTube videos about like fashion designers, like Virgil Abloh, but it wasn't like it's one time. It's one thing to see it one time, but every time I see him, he was consistently watching and taking notes, and I'm confused. Like, what's homeboy actor model over here doing? And then just dive into what happened during the pandemic.
Yeah. So then during the pandemic, I'd always felt like fashion was like my subliminal calling, but there was like things that overrided it, like athletics, school, you know, and also not having a blueprint from the East Coast where you're like, I mean, yeah, I like this, but where do you take it? Like, what, just put on fits? At that time, Instagram and all that stuff wasn't around. So, you know, dressing up to get views wasn't even a pathway.
Right.
So, you know, my grandfather passed away during the pandemic in 2020, and that honestly jolted me in a different way, where I was like, I need whatever I need to accomplish and whatever I think I can accomplish, I need to do it now, and I'm not going to waste any more time. So I truly believed I could start a brand. I had worked with the best brands in the world at that time, so I saw from front of the camera, behind the camera, what this thing really took. And I had never been overly, and this is no offense to any of the production, but I'd never been overly impressed to the point where I'm like, I can't do that. Everything that I saw them doing, I truly believed I could do and 10 times better. And so I started just learning everything, like from everything foundationally, how to build a business, how to be a fashion designer, how to be a creative director, how to be a producer, how to be a stylist, like literally just watching the best, like, you know, and actually teaching myself all these things. And, you know, I just started drawing designs, came up with the brand name, which was Not Water. And I wanted to create a brand that embodied, you know, my grandfather's risk-taking, you know, moving my family from Nigeria to the US and like my mom having that opportunity, quite frankly, of a lifetime, because my mom's brother didn't move, but she was the oldest and then the smartest. So I'm like, just that combination, like the fact that my mom was the oldest, but she was a woman, my brother's still her twin, but she's smarter. Like, mm-hmm. So it's like things like that. I'm like, God just dropped a little extra just so I could have, you know, an opportunity. And yeah, the brand started from there. I started off doing eyewear. Then the eyewear ended up doing really well. And then I just went into jewelry, went into apparel, and things just started brewing from there.
So you mentioned your brand being Not Water. Why how did you come up with that title, and what does it actually mean?
Yeah, so
it's not dripped. Go ahead, give it to him.
Yeah, so Not Water, it stands for not neglecting our talents, willing to take risks. And the whole brand is about inspiring people to take that next step in life. And, you know, just when I realized my experiences over the years, I was like, wow, if I never took a risk every single time, I would not even be close to where I'm today. If I stayed in Boston, I'm not here.
And that was the acronym he just gave me right now.
Yeah. And I literally just creating something that embodied that energy, you know, because I knew people naturally met me, naturally heard my story, they would understand the brand a lot more and like why I'm doing it. And so, yeah, I was like, Not Water. Then.
And you can only get this from Three Tribesmen, just to let y'all know. So just to let you know. Nice. But that's what's up.
It's actually a very funny catchphrase. Like it's like what he's wearing right now. It's Not Water. It's drip.
Yeah, it's Not Water. It's drip. Like, and it's like, and it also, and then it started developing further meanings. Like, you know, I always hated doing things the conventional way. I never wanted to do things the right way. I never fit into the crowd. And so Not Water is just for people who are, they're just not like everything else. You're not
conventional. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to go with the flow. You're not going to just accept an idea. You're not just going to accept a premise or a lane. Like moment to moment, I don't like, I have enough discernment where like I can understand, but I can understand and cope with what you're thinking, but what I ingest and bring into my life is what I'm going to actually truly do. And, you know, the brand has just strengthened that belief.
This brand is like, I think you're being very humble with this brand. I mean, there's been famous people who've put on your brand. Mm-hmm. Like, how does that even make you feel? Let's talk about some of the people that you've worked with your brand, some of the countries that you're in, some of the stores that you're in. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like you got to talk your shit, man. Like, you
got to
go. Come on.
Yeah, no, I feel you. You know, sometimes, like, you know, I can be very, very chill, very
You're modest. Motivating a lot of people out there that still have question mark. Like, I don't know if I should make this even happen. There might be somebody out there even watching this looking at you like, man, if this guy can do it, especially a Nigerian guy, I mean, the odds are, I mean, come on. Just talking about your parents. I look at the same thing, too, like, if my mom never had that leap of faith to just say, I'm going to move to America, where would I be today?
Facts.
You know, and it's not like she was just like trying to be American. No, it was just she had the leap of faith. I'm coming to America. And then I'll have a lot of family members in America. I mean, our lives could have been a lot different. Not saying for the better, for the worse. If our parents decided, you know what? We're just going to sit here and not do anything with our lives and just stay back home in Nigeria. And then that's your upbringing, you know. But the fact that you're talking about your grandfather and then your mother and now you, I mean, there's people out there watching this like, this guy did all that in a short period of time. So yeah, talk about the brand, some of the stuff that you, I mean, you can be humble and all that, but you gotta, you know, you worked hard for this moment.
This is your time to brag, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
So, I guess the first big artist we worked with was Chris Brown. We worked with him on the Iffy music video, which was like probably his biggest hit in 2021. And I created customized bags for Chris, customized sunglasses. He wore the bag in his video, all his backup dancers wore the sunglasses. That was really our first big celebrity exposure. and honestly, confidence for the brand, because when you're starting a brand, nothing's going well. Right. You know, I mean, things are going well. You know, there's things out of control of like our campaigns, things of that nature. But in terms of like revenue drivers, placements, like, and to get such a high placement like that was honestly legendary for us. And honestly motivated me to continue going. And then we ended up getting picked up by TJ Maxx in Canada. So that was like a major big box retailer where they expanded our eyewear division to 500 plus stores. Nice. I've been working with them consistently for 3 years now. We never expanded into the US because we wanted just a different focus, like, for our product in the US. So I made sure I channeled that focus because I knew I was going to come out with clothing and I wanted to start a luxury fashion brand. So obviously TJ Maxx, a little bit more affordable, but we're in like the runway division next to brands like Prada, Gucci, David Beckham. Brands like that. So it got us to keep that still high light. But in the US, I ended up focusing on getting into 5-star hotels and really pinpointing, you know, the exact area. So I wanted to be in the only luxury areas.
Yeah,
I
didn't want to be in like downtown. Beverly Hills.
Yeah, so we're in the Beverly Center. We sell at the One Hotel, the Mondrian, Andaz, the London Hotel. We sell in Las Vegas at one of the hottest malls in Las Vegas. We sell in New York City at the Oculus Center, Boston. I'm in 3 stores in Boston, which is really cool just because that's where I grew up. Canada, Miami. Yeah, so we have 20 plus retail locations across, I think, 7 different states. And then the big box retailer expands us to 500. So if we really counted it, it's like 520. And then we just have I've been working on a lot of cool collabs. We're doing a collab with probably... we're doing a collab with probably the biggest gym like in the US, like where the biggest celebrities go to. So you got people
I already know.
Yeah. it costs nearly $40K a year just to attend the gym. Wow. So we're doing a collab with them. We have a collab with UCLA, the football team.
Nice.
That we're gonna announce in the fall season. We're doing New York Fashion Week. We're doing Miami Fashion Week, LA Fashion Week. We just did Boston Fashion Week.
I gotta attend New York Fashion Week just once though.
Yeah,
New York. Talking about going to Paris. Paris Fashion Week.
For sure, that's on the list. It's on the list. No worries.
Paris is like kind of like the pinnacle, right? Like, you know, once we achieve that, we know we've really got the eyes on us because it's the European market. So the American market's always cool. And, but at the end of the day, like, we want to be a global brand.
Facts.
So, you know, once you kind of, you know, hit all these sectors, you know, now you're in the system. And I think, you know, understanding what it takes for a brand to develop, luxury is very aspirational. So, people have to aspire to want your brand.
Facts.
You know, most of the time it actually isn't good if most people can just go into a luxury store and just buy everything. Like, there's no aspiration, right? Like, that's, you go into Target and you can get whatever you want. You don't go into Louis Vuitton and get whatever you want, unless you're balling out of control. Yeah, right. Then that's a different story. So, you know, I wanted to create, you know, a luxury experience. And so that's why I'm so meticulous with everything that we design. We focus on a lot of denim, sustainable materials, really high quality, sourcing from the nicest brands, so like Levi's, Carhartt, Gapnet, 1989, Calvin Klein, Wrangler jeans. So the sustainability aspect and kind of adding, you know, putting like my 1% into creating a better world was really important for me. So those are things that we've been working on.
Let me ask. All right, I was gonna say. I wanted to ask the last one, but if you got something, I'll go ahead.
I was going to ask you. So it sounds like you have like a whole team. Do you have a team behind you? Is this something like, are you kind of doing it mainly by yourself? Do you have a team of people kind of supporting you as far as being able to put placement everywhere and manufacturing the goods and everything like that? Like, how does that look for you?
Yeah, so I would say placement-wise, retail, I've placed myself in every retailer. If I couldn't really give... I don't even really know who to give credit for that besides myself, because I woke up every day, and I pitched all those people. Nice. You know, they heard from me first, and they continue to hear from me.
Right.
And then on the manufacturing side, I had to find all those people. So honestly, everything with the brand, nothing was given to me. I had to really fight for it, to find the best manufacturers, to sample test. Yeah, you got to put your money behind it. Like, Timmy lived with me, so he saw how many samples come into the house. Right. Like, bro, you just buy this shit, you don't even know. I'm like, bro, you got to sample test. Mm-hmm. Like, or else you... And because
I didn't even know how much goes into even having the glasses. I was mm-hmm. like, you got to mold this stuff. You got to do what? You got to mm-hmm. design this. Somebody got to print this. And you got to go to this pair for the label, mm-hmm. the box and the shipping. I learned a lot just from just watching you do all of this stuff like mm-hmm. that's remarkable, man. And you were talking about the stuff you do. To me, I was like, man, you worked hard, man. Mm-hmm. You've worked hard for even being in these stores. You've worked hard for even being present to travel. Mm-hmm. Some of this stuff are coming from your savings account. Mm-hmm. You damn near go broke.
Yeah.
Trying to create something you believe in. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was like gonna say, like, yeah, you talk about the highlight, give us some of the lowlights. Like, mm-hmm. what are some things that you've had to struggle with? You know, and it can be brief. Like, what are some of the things that has challenged you? Because you can't just say it's been a smooth ride this whole time. Yeah, it might seem like it.
Yeah. But I would say one of the earliest struggles was like on the eyewear side. Like, we launched so strong. I put so much money into the production, probably just to start the brand. Probably like my first project, I probably put like 50K into my first project just personally. And then to get the aesthetics of the brand and sample test so aggressively because quality was so important to me,
right.
I had to sample test aggressively. So let's say, For a sweatshirt, if I want to sample test a sweatshirt, I'm paying $300 to $400 every single time because I'm challenging them to make the very best mm-hmm. thing. And if they say, oh, we can't make this, I'm like, I'll pay you more to make it. And so it's like stretching the boundaries of like what's even out there just because I think it could be better was like, I had to really put my money where my mouth is. And like, that's where I really learned, you know, that I wanted to do this. So I remember sitting in my apartment and there was, I think, over 1,000 sunglasses, and I probably had sold maybe like, let's say my launch party, had some friends support, probably sold like maybe 40 or something. I'm looking, I'm like, damn, I thought I was gonna sell all this shit. Like, and it really being shook, like, like, damn, this shit's no joke. And you know, I was like, I just gotta put in the work. Like, I gotta really make sure I get this thing moving. But even more so when I went from an eyewear company to selling apparel, I still remember ordering everything, and it's in my crib, over 100K worth of apparel. And I'm sitting there like, whew, if I can't sell this, I'm willing to wear every single piece. And I was like, if I can't sell this, I'm buying clothes ever again.
Dude, like, every day. Call me Dr. Dre.
Like, don't matter. Crop. We go crop this thing. Like, you know, and from that moment, like once I put my, that's the one thing I think about me that I start to realize is like, once I put myself in very high pressured situations, I never crack. And that's why I'm like, that's when the diamonds.
That's the Nigerian in you.
Excel under pressure.
You like put your back against the wall and just fight.
That's how you,
yeah,
that's
just
how you
got to do it.
Like, what's up?
Yeah, so, like, what's good?
All right. So, cause I know you got a lot of things, and we appreciate your time even being here, giving us your time and everything. But just the last question that I would like to get off, cause I think this is very important. Mm-hmm. Have you ever sat back and actually like looked at the accomplishment starting from your mother, your parents, onto you going to college, and then from what you have done so far? Like, have you actually stopped? Because I know we, especially as Nigerians or Africans, for sure, I'm not going to say Nigerians, just Africans, period. Mm-hmm. We always are worried about like in the moment, yeah. Have you ever like sat back and ever just been like, I'm happy with what I've done? Like, mm-hmm. have you ever been that?
It's crazy because, it's crazy because the moment took too long to come, but it was probably like in the past 2 or 3 months like that I really like sat back, and I had to really take a step back because you say all these things you want forever. Like, I want this. Like, I remember my goals, like, get on a billboard, get on TV, get in front of stores, get on magazines, work with Vogue, work with this person, start a brand, all these things, get into stores. And I had to just take, take a step back, like, bro, like, these things are all actively happening. And, you know, I had moments where, like, I, you know, I just broke down and I crying, thanking God, like, being so
grateful,
happy, like, overwhelmingly, like, is like when it really sits on you, like, and then the reality of it, like, so, like, the type of people I'm working, and then, you know, to see, like, the success, not only just from a financial, but from a community aspect, like, you know, to go out and I've gone out just casually, like, I'd be wearing shades a lot, and I try to be inconspicuous when I go out. I just like that vibe, but to see people wear my brand, like, they don't even know I'm in the same room, but they're wearing my stuff. Or, like, people send videos like, yo, I was at this concert.
And I'm like, yo, this guy got your shit. He got your stuff on. It just feels cool to see that, because I know where this room, I know where you started seeing that. And now even in Africa, like I was going to say real quick before we get out of here, is I need you to talk about, like, your involvement in Africa too, because you're also very involved.
Yeah.
You donate, you're in stores, like, you're working with some people out there too. You want to talk about that briefly?
Yeah.
Real quick.
So one of my biggest initiatives this year is to donate a lot of sunglasses specifically and clothes, but to also, like, empower African designers. So there's a lot of dope African designers I've been able to talk to over the past couple of years, like, and they're doing amazing stuff. And, like, the one thing that I've realized across all of them that they really just need, they just really need someone to believe in them.
That's it.
That's really it. They're not asking me for money. They're not asking me to be introduced.
A lot of doubters, man.
Like, they just want me to be on the ground and to believe in them. And maybe it's words, or maybe it's
exposure,
like, my
input, anything.
Whatever it is, but it's just the fact that they're getting the energy. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm very adamant about, like, we've given back to Africa, but I'm very adamant about giving way more back, but empowering people, whether it's through my network, whether it's through my finances, whether it's through my gifts and or just opportunities, bringing people. You know, we want to, one of the contests we want to do in Africa is, like, to give away 1,000 sunglasses. But instead of, if you want to design on the sunglasses, you can present your designs to Not Water, and the 3 best designs will sell on our website and all of our retailers.
That's
so
dope.
We've got our retailers to back that idea, which is really dope. So, we're just excited to just do more, because I really started this thing, like, I always tell people, like, if I wanted to make money, there was a lot of other things I had opportunities to make money from, you know, and so it was really a community and a passion thing. And now the fact that it's making money is just a plus, but it's still not the end goal. Yeah, we want to make money, because you got to live and you got to finance your projects, but it's really about, you know, the impact and purpose. So. That's
perfect. Hey. So right here on this camera, right here, let everybody know where they can get in contact with you, look at all your apparel, all the stuff.
What's good, y'all? So Obi Nwankwo, CEO of Not Water and founder. You can check us out at notwater.com, which is KNOTWTR. And then you can also check us out on social media, which is KNOTWTR. Do a lot of exciting things and, tap in with the community.
Perfect. Hey. Good talking with you guys,
bro.
Did
it again. Thank you, my brother.
Thank you, bro.
That's great.
My guy.